admit any weakness or failure. What would the press say if the prognosis was poor? But surgery left me naked to myself and to the world, with prostate and camouflage removed. Shortcomings, weaknesses, frailties, vulnerabilities, inadequacies, self-doubts, and all. My total reality in plain sight. No less flawed than most, and no longer burdened by the need to appear otherwise. At every point through all the years before, the greatest threat to my life's program had been my fear of failure. Not failure itself, mind you, but my fear of failure. And now, once the surgery had been scheduled, I managed to translate the publicity I knew would result into a full-scale worldwide failure thing. I had enjoyed so many successes over the years that my lifelong fear of failure had been relegated to the sub-basement. But it had remained alive and well down there, ready to come out with a roar with the cancer diagnosis. With blunt honesty, my cancer said, "You're not a star. You're a human being, vulnerable like the rest." My whole existence up to that point had been based on the mantra, "I will be better. I will be better. I am better." Now this life-threatening disease demanded that I face the hypocrisy of that charade. In the months that followed the removal of my prostate, I grew to see myself as a combination of things and a recipient of many blessings, not the least of which were the influences of luck, timing, and all of the other mysteries that went into the making of my life. Though one can never put one's finger on such intangibles, one nevertheless knows that they are real and are definitely a part of the mix. I'm a person who's never lost sight of appreciation for anything I've had above subsistence. When I went to pick up my first check as an actor in a film, I was afraid that the studio would see the truth, which was that I was so happy to be acting that if I had had the money and they had asked me, I would have paid them for the privilege. I still watch money, having learned the hard way, and I spend it with a certain mindfulness. I try to be reasoned in my dealings with money, because somewhere inside myself, I've always been afraid that I'd be judged unworthy of it. With me always are recollections of lines from the early years. Lines like, "Ah, well, they haven't caught up with me yet." I often heard another kind of comment as well during those early years. People would say things like, "You get paid for this?" I still hear that one. Or people would say, "How you doing?" And answer, "Not bad for colored." Later, I would discover how many meanings that last comment carried in the black community. Among other things, it was a bonding expression born of racial matters and widely used as a reminder of all the dreams shared in common. That's the way it was. "Are you working hard or are you hardly working?" Big answer, "Doing all right." And keeping a straight face was a part of it. Oh, my life and days, yes. In ways subtle and otherwise, a scarcity of money goes a long way in shaping the vocabulary of a community. A sobering rediscovery of an awareness I had relinquished to denial came back to me with jolting clarity when I was in the post-surgery stage. That awareness was that I had come to believe a little bit in my own press clippings. Having been a principal player in motion pictures for a very long time, mine was considered a successful career, and certainly it had provided a good living for my family and me. I've received plenty of recognition, and I'm well thought of throughout a sizable portion of the world. Moreover, I've become closely identified with several of the parts I've played: uplifting, interesting, positive, good guys, brave, and with dignity. You can't receive and enjoy those kudos and that kind of acceptance without some of it going to your head. A little bit, anyway. And if you keep hearing it, somewhere along the way you start accepting it as truth. I had, in fact, reached that point. I enjoyed believing much of the praise I heard. It brought me good feelings of acceptance, feelings of worthiness, usefulness. I was thought of as someone with a gift, a skill, a craft, and one that hadn't been wasted or abused. Bathe in all that praise, I had lost touch with my own personal measure of myself, a more realistic assessment that incorporated the weaknesses and foibles, the generosity and the darkness, the human vulnerability. There were even times during bouts of doubt and depression and feelings of inadequacy that I found myself giving the public image a boost. While manipulating and inflating that image, I would ease my conscience by referring to my actions as a gentle massage necessary for the sake of maintenance. There are different kinds of strength, you know. My parents weren't people of great power, commanding huge resources. Much of the time they simply clung to life on an island that could have been reclaimed by the sea at any moment. But they carried on with great dignity, and they accomplished much. There was a kind of strength in their existence that I hadn't been forced by difficult circumstances to practice. But now, with cancer and an uncertain future looming, I knew that the moment had found me. I couldn't not try to summon their strength. I knew that if I was going to die as a result of this disease, I had to find the strength to face death with some dignity, some courage, and some acceptance of the inevitable. Some honesty. Especially when I had to say to my wife, here are the possibilities. In preparing her as best I could, I tried to let her know that I was concerned, but not panicked, so that she would gain strength from that to carry her through whatever would be the outcome. When I was quite young, with no awareness of the personal demons within me or the different forms and faces those demons could endlessly assume, I developed a belief system that was fraught with danger. I had come to believe that the hard work of good, honest, fair-minded people with a passionate commitment to justice would bring about a world in which a life of dignity for all would be the rule, a world in which opportunities to pursue fulfillment would be limited only by the outer margins of one's individual ability. I had come to believe that problems of race, ethnicity, color, education, sexual preference, class, and poverty, and the abundant afflictions left in their wake to plague the modern world in their names, would be successfully resolved through the efforts of those same good, honest, fair-minded people. A new progressive force with insight and cohesion was in the making, thought I. The ills of my generation would ultimately be addressed. Friction would be tamed, tensions neutralized, and out of the hearts and minds of good men and women would come the way to a better future, one in which we would all lend a hand at weaving the strong cultural threads of our social diversity into a more caring, a more human community. Bullshit. At 18, I was plenty old enough to damn well know better than that. And if it sounds like I've rendered a self-assessment too harsh in light of my age, trust me, I haven't. I was wrong to embrace that crap. Spending my impressionable years operating in the real world on such wishful thinking wasn't only too costly, it was also too dangerous. I well remember as a young man learning day by day to test my wings in life by stepping farther and farther away from my ignorance. Then one day, at a bold distance from the safety of that ignorance, I finally spotted my demons. First one, then another, then another. Some people don't want to know of the presence of personal demons. They pretend not to know even when they do know. And there are others whose consciousness merely dances around the edges of their dark side reality all their lives. Those folks never step close enough to look even one demon in the eye. But listen, the day one decides to take the reins of one's own life into one's own hands to captain one's own ship, that's the day the dance around the edges starts to slow down, bringing that person to a place where gnawing questions will no longer lie still. To a place where one just can't help wondering why so often in life an obvious solution to a question gets twisted and pulled into a knot of frustration with no regard for logic or reason. To a place where one finds oneself more and more at a loss to explain why logic and reason themselves so often go down in defeat at the hands of energies that are negative, hostile, destructive, and cruel. I don't remember exactly when I began to ask myself those questions that wouldn't lie still. But when I did, they led me to endless face-to-face encounters between myself and the dark side of my own nature. That part of me that has always been there, saying to my deaf ears, "I'm here, and one day you'll be ready to take me into account." On that day, you're gonna have to take me into account. You aren't ever going to manage through your life without coming by me. Age-old speculation as to whether the dark side is full-blown in some people and almost non-existent in others, or is distributed more widely, some in everyone, rages still from generation to generation. I personally think that there's some darkness in everyone, though the sum varies as widely as do personality profiles in the family of man. Darkness can explode in nuclear proportions with disastrous consequences or make itself felt in small, subtle, irritating ways, depending on the day, the time, the hour, the situation, and who's in the room. The extent of the dark side isn't easy to fathom. People who kill aren't evil 24 hours a day, and the dark side doesn't advertise. The dark side in each of us operates from behind masks of varying complexity, coming to the fore when we elect to use its services. We all have a reservoir of rage, dissatisfaction, self-loathing, unhappiness, intolerable feelings of inadequacy. But we don't necessarily express these things. They're veiled, hidden from ourselves as much as from others. But whether hidden or not, they make us all capable of terrible things. And the evil that we are capable of enacting doesn't flourish only in moments of rage or revenge, or in response to some unspeakable offense. Sometimes horrible acts are entertained and allowed under very considered and thought-through circumstances. Everybody is entitled to a job, someone might say, but not my job. You try to take my job, and I'll kill you. Sometimes the violence in the dark side is turned inward. Some people take pills. Some jump out of windows. But whether violence is turned inward or outward, people can't isolate components of their rage. It's an accumulation. We think we are raging against the darkness, but in fact we are struggling against a life we can't control. We opt to struggle for balance rather than fight chaos. "What got into him?" people ask of a well-mannered neighbor who turned ballistic. "He isn't that kind of guy." But of course he is. We're all that kind of guy. Do I have the wherewithal to be a violent person? Of course I do. I could do unspeakable things to protect my children. Would that be a choice made at that precise moment? Yes. But where would I go for that intensity? Into what well of murderous impulses would I dip? That reservoir has to be there already, waiting. For me, this awareness was the beginning of a new perception of self, of others, and of the world around me. In light of my growing understanding, I took aggressive steps to try to find out why my best efforts had so often been defied by problems I would have thought were fixable. I boldly peeked inward, saw nothing I understood, then retreated again to ponder where inside myself I should look for answers to external human problems that defy one's best efforts. I spent much time looking in the wrong places, but even there I came away with lessons. For example, some things simply aren't going to get better. And some people just refuse to learn. If learning isn't good for them, doesn't profit them, they're not interested. So what else should that worldview have encompassed? Having grown up in an idyllic place that I mistakenly believed held the whole story, if I could just discern it, my determination to find the answer to that question pulled me into a process that led to discovery. The first conclusion that struck me was that the pace toward progress was slower than it should be. Growing increasingly impatient with that pace, I observed it closely and found out that the problem wasn't pace, but direction. I concluded that other people and other forces weren't just going slowly, they were trying to go another way, another place altogether. There were parts of me as well, of every individual, that were trying to go other places altogether. I also drew some conclusions about the educability of human beings. I had tended to believe in the essential nobility of man, had seen man as noble beast, and had thought that education could bring about change. Anything good and necessary that wasn't happening was missing, I had thought, because of someone who didn't understand yet. But I came to believe that while there are, in fact, some people who haven't yet been shown, there are far more who are never, ever going to see, regardless of what they're shown and how often. I also concluded that what it is we need to see, that big answer we all seek, is even more complex than it appears to be, more than a value system and its opposite held in degrees by various people, more than the vague but persistent sense that somewhere inside ourselves lie hidden such answers as would be appropriate to questions we are not yet fearless enough to ask. Questions like, for instance, how much truth is there in the lingering suspicion that nature is fooling with us? Are we principal players with pivotal roles in her scenario, as we fervently hope, or merely inconsequential afterthoughts with not the slightest impact on her agenda, as we often fear? Why do we spend most or all of our lives searching for balance between the bewildering variety of opposites designed in nature's nature? Why do we struggle so hard to find a comfort zone between up and down, in and out, here and there, this and that, him and her, us and them, high and low? Ever present is this duality, and ever present is our need to articulate ourselves betwixt the various poles. I concluded finally that in the juxtaposition of energies, nature's intent was major, the idea of the other, the definition of self by its opposite. I am not that. I further concluded that if such duality in so many aspects of her being was necessary to nature's sense of herself, her sustenance, her continuance, her survival, then duality must be a fundamental circumstance in her overall design. It must represent a basic, basic truth. That collision is essential, that opposites create an energy, and that maybe nature has no preference for either of the opposites. What arrogance we possess, then, to think that there is a preference in favor of our side. Instead, nature waits for us to discover that her focus is on the energy which ensues from the coming together of yin and yang, and the coming together of high and low, and the coming together of this and that, and the coming together of us and them, all that blood on Wild Kingdom. We accept it in the animal world. In our world, we say it's dog eat dog, and it sounds like a bad thing. But we talk about the food chain on the Serengeti Plain and give it civilized acceptability with polished terms like zoology. During a bull session one evening, wrestling with this issue over after-dinner coffee, my buddy Charlie Blackwell said to me, "You know, we're not talking just about a process in nature. We're talking about a process that might be nature itself." I took this to be a warning for us not to take ourselves too seriously. We were, after all, just two guys with little more than a fair amount of curiosity, trying to stretch our minds by chewing on an issue light years bigger than our bite, he seemed to be saying. I signaled my accord with that cautionary sentiment, and also its use as ground rule to cover the deeper discussion that was likely to come. At that point, he reached in his knapsack and hauled out his trusted little tape recorder, positioned it on the table, and said, "Okay, let's see where this nature's use of opposites thing leads." "You first," said I. "Okay," said he. "Let's look at it in the same light as if it were the New Testament, Frank Capra, USA, Judeo-Christian dream that sustained us growing up and for a great deal of our adult lives. Then we found out that the dream was a dream, that it was inaccurate and incomplete. But we also discovered that that dream and the inaccuracy of it had kept us alive and allowed us to survive. All of us believed in John Wayne. Later on we said, well, he's a conservative. But the essential winning through and by God we'll get there and over the hill, huh? And hard work, and we'll get there, and be true and loyal, and all those other things. That's what kept us going. Now, knowing that, that A, the dream kept us going, and B, it isn't true, what do we tell the children? Do we tell them to keep the Capra, let them find out the truth for themselves, or do we tell them..." Here I interrupted. "Would what we now perceive as truth be so tough for them to handle?" I asked. "Why not share with them what we've observed? Tell them that it appears that nature doesn't give doodly squat about the whites and the blacks and the browns and the blues. That on the evidence she looks to be operating in her own best interest, and we, as best can be told, are a part of how she operates and not vice versa. That we believe her to have no preference between opposites, but feel that her focus falls sharpest on the clashing of opposing forces in mutual annihilation. If we speak of basic facts, truths, constant realities that are forever there, then of course a lot of dreams will be stripped away, sending Capra and John Wayne right out the window. But how bad is that? If the children hear our thoughts about opposing forces in mutual annihilation providing energy by which nature perpetuates herself, and they learn thereby that the browns, the blues, the whites, the blacks, and whatever combination there are, will continually go clash, flash, slash, wham, bang, boom, boom, and not know why. Then the children will be the better for it. Otherwise, they will grow up to hear each other exclaim, 'Oh, my God. God, these people don't understand. Why can't we get them to learn? Why can't we get them to see? We've got to show them.' And they would remain unaware that nature sees all while her interest encompasses only the sparks that fly." Right, Charlie conceded. But if you'd known that truth when you were a kid, before you left Nassau, would that truth have taken away from the hope that kept you alive? What we're really talking about is Santa Claus. We know that there's no Santa Claus, but we're grown up. We're talking about when we let the children become aware that there's no Santa Claus. Hope, Charlie, I said, is always born out of the same womb. It doesn't matter what your level is. If you're a child, your hope comes from the place where your imagination and your little bit of knowledge tells you that things are most favorable. Where you get comfort, warmth, kisses, where you get cared for, where you get fed. Your hope is all intertwined with that, with the people who do the feeding, when they feed you, how they feed you, how they protect you from the elements, and so on. But take that child to 10 or 12 years old and share with him our adult speculation about nature, about what nature does and how it operates. And that child then would have to begin to articulate his or her hopes and dreams on the basis of that understanding. I paused for breath. In other words, hopes and dreams are necessary tools to the survival instinct. With the acceptance of new truths, hopes and dreams become subject to rewriting according to the needs of the new reality. On the other hand, hopelessness sneaks about on the periphery of our lives, waiting to close in on us behind certain truths. But Charlie, it's watched and held in check at a safe distance by our instinct to survive. Of course, when hopelessness succeeds in narrowing the distance enough to infect hopes and dreams and slowly sap their strengths, then the instinct to survive falters, yes, begins to wear down. And if it's ever subdued to a point where it can no longer churn out the stuff from which dreams are spun to give flight to hope, then one resigns oneself to what follows. And over time, hopelessness lays claim to another victim. But, as the old saying goes, as long as there's life, there's hope. Is that an assumption? Charlie asked. As long as there's life, there's hope? Yeah. Well, you have to qualify the line, I said. As long as there's a chance for the life you envision, and so on. And hope isn't planted in us, inquired Charlie. It isn't a vision given to us as we grow up by surroundings such as movies, patriotic books, attitudes of people around us, you know, what Studs Terkel called the good war. Yeah, it's planted some, but it's there from the beginning, too. I think it shares a primal bond with pleasure. I'm talking about general, basic hope, said Charlie. You know, hope 101, the hope which is a kind of belief that things, people, conditions, whatever, can get better. That hope is constant, Charlie. But let's examine what we mean by things, and what do we mean by better? We have to define better as well. I took a moment to marshal my thoughts. Let's go back to the time when we were unaware that nature might be operating the way we now suspect she does. At that point, hope was qualitatively different. But now, when we assume, as we do, the possibility that nature doesn't give doodly squat beyond the flying sparks that are important to our sustenance, we then say, hey, wait a minute. What is it that I want? The hell with nature. She's getting hers. What is it that I want? Well, I want a better life. Okay, I continued. Before you can achieve a better life, you've got to be able to spell out what a better life means, what it means for you, not for your neighbor or the white guy across the tracks, for you. You're probably going to say a better life is more comforts. And those comforts are of a great variety. I want to be more comfortable emotionally. I want to be more comfortable physically. I want to be more comfortable psychologically. More comfortable with myself, with my neighbors. Aside from comfort, I want to feel good in my consciousness of myself and my existence. I want to feel good about things. Charlie nodded agreement and poured another cup of coffee. Okay. What things? I pressed. You might say, I want to feel good about what goes on around me. I want to feel good about the way I'm thought of, the way I think of myself. Good about how my friends see me and how they feel with me and how they accept me. I want to feel good about the things I do for myself and for my children, for my wife, my friends, and my community. I want to feel good in other ways, too. I want to feel pleasurably good. Ideally, I would like life to be as close to an orgasm as it can get, and who wouldn't? So my call is this. Hope essentially is goal-oriented. And however else one may define hope, there's no denying the likelihood that comfort, feeling good, and pleasures are basic ingredients in the stuff that hope spins into dreams. Therefore, when hope attains an occasional goal, a dream or part of a dream is realized, causing us to feel that much better about ourselves. How much, you ask, is due to hope implanted by books and movies, and how much to inborn urges and instincts whose natural orientation is towards the pursuit of pleasure? Well, if a harder look at things and better doesn't provide a satisfactory answer, it should at least give us a clearer view of how hope matches up to reality and how dreams keep us keeping on. Charlie looked at me a moment, then said, "Now that we're here looking back across our years, the children, what shall we tell them about our journey? What shall we tell them about ourselves?" "The truth," I said, without hesitation. "That life is tough." "Life is tough, damn right." The Measure of a Man. In the professional theater, audiences are known to have been swept out of their individual realities and transported to imaginary places and to imaginary times that appeared as real as any place or time out of their own experience. I once was well acquainted with such occurrences. On more than a few occasions, I was present on one side of the footlights or another when actors and audience conspired to make magic. Time and again, I witnessed some unknown force take hold and keep us transfixed to the evening's end, then release us gently and send us home with gifts of remembrances to last for a lifetime. For me, over the decades, much of the purity gradually faded from that process, giving way to a tolerable sameness. I had a film career to manage, as well as a directing career, a family to raise, business to take care of. And as I grew older, the events on my calendar began to take on a more retrospective flavor. Testimonial dinners and awards ceremonies, sometimes for colleagues, sometimes for myself. Documentaries and interviews as film historians and others looked back to recapture some essence of my time in Hollywood. It was as if I had become a living repository and not much more. Then, a few years ago, on an early spring evening at the Mark Taper Theater in Los Angeles, the magic of theater returned in full bloom for me. Actress Anne DeVere Smith was on stage in a solo performance, and as I sat mesmerized, I surrendered completely to her craftsmanship. She had so captured the imagination of the audience that we were all a living part of the world she had created on that Mark Taper stage. She had convinced us that all the magic laid out in front of us was real. When the final curtain fell, I was elated. In addition to the pleasure of the experience, I also felt a hunger. One that had lain dormant for years suddenly began to gnaw inside me. Out of the power of her artistry, one actress alone populated that stage with a variety of characters and brought to life settings that could be seen only through the eyes of the imagination and touched only by the finger of wonder. Throughout the evening, She had complete command of my senses, and for good reason. She had taken me back to times that had slipped from memory. Early in my struggling years as an actor, I had no knowledge of the word pantomime. When I was introduced to it in an acting class, I was intrigued by its complexity. To tell a story without words, to convey physically all the nuances of tragedy, comedy, and drama. Nuances that would ordinarily be illuminated by words appeared to me to be creativity of a very special kind. It wasn't long before I began to devise comic pantomimes and present them in acting classes with encouraging results. Soon I had developed a repertoire good enough to roll out at parties as entertainment for friends. My confidence that pantomime would grow steadily in the following 2 years. I actually began fantasizing about honing my sketches into a nightclub routine. Soon enough, however, the idea of pantomime and nightclubs was abandoned in the wake of a gathering film career that would eventually absorb my focus to the exclusion of all else. Left beneath the swirling shadows of Hollywood's intoxicating promise, such notions withered and faded, slowly slipping from memory's reach to lie dormant for decades. Then, that night at the Mark Taper, they suddenly reawakened as part of a creative explosion at the center of my consciousness. They came to life in a cluster of long-forgotten, unfulfilled desires that I had abandoned and left to perish, along with once strong urges that had been either unmet or ignored so long that they too had faded or crumbled into dust. So much had been dreamed of, I thought to myself. So much had been left undone. Then, like a bolt out of the blue, came a realization. It was something I never, ever should have forgotten. A credo. A deeply held conviction, a challenge in waiting. For most of my life in films and theater, I had believed that an actor should repeatedly seek to have his measure taken by challenges inherent in his craft. Every actor should aim always towards earning a place among those privileged members of his profession who are considered by most to be creative, artistic, and suited to their calling. I had always known that the very best way for me to improve self and craft was to continually test my limits. And I knew, on that evening of my realization, I was in my mid-60s at that time, that the ideal way to do that would still be to walk onto an empty stage, face an audience alone, and for 2 hours spin words, talent, skill, and craft into magic enough to seduce that audience into my imagination and have them invite me into theirs. All through my career, I had been driven by a huge need to stay on my toes in life as well as on the stage. Backed by the brashness of youth and a recklessness of thought, that need was translated into a warning that was always with me. Don't be as good as, be better than. Raise the risk level. Vague recollections suggest that I even managed on occasion to forge discipline out of resolve. But looking back from the distance of that early spring evening at the Mark Taper, I realized that I had forgotten all that. I had tarried too long in places where success had tempted me into lowering my risk level. But at least I could feel the need to rattle this cage of my own making. Before the evening was over, that need came rushing forth as the powerful urge to step on a stage, face an audience, and test my limits once again. Revitalized and pulsating, the old theatrical impulse I had met at the American Negro Theater came charging upwards to flex itself in the presence of all the magic it sensed being spun everywhere around us. It also came to take a look at me and once again vibrate through my body. And in that reawakening, the impulse was as forceful as I had ever known it to be, which was, of course, a reassuring surprise. There it was, that old compulsion standing in the wings. We recognized each other instantly. It hadn't changed, as far as I could tell. It was still dangerous. I knew that it would demand of me the same commitment it had required years before. In looking each other over, we both could see that I had changed. With age, I had grown increasingly cautious, and over time I had, conveniently, forgotten about that old bond between us. How could I have forgotten how much we had in common? Forgotten how often I had been attracted and repulsed at the same time. Forgotten how often in my dreams we had teamed up and scored. Now, that old compulsion had returned to stare back at me from the center of my consciousness. I felt its power reaching out to me, trying to take hold. Yet, I felt comfortable in my distance, still capable of standing my ground. In the magic of that evening, the flirtation began exactly where it had left off when I was young and unafraid of looking inward in search of whatever I might find. When something living in the darkness was discovered, tugging at the sleeves of my imagination. And our flirtation moved quickly to action, as flirtations often do. On that evening at the Mark Taper, I decided that there could be no better time than that moment for me to explore the long-forgotten, unfulfilled urge that had once possessed me, to engage compulsion on all matters of unfinished business between us, to look around inside myself at roadways that had once seemed to lead nowhere in particular and ask why they had been dead ends. What was it about those roadways? Were they overwhelmed by challenges too great? Were they intercepted by risks too high? Were they restrained by regrets too painful? Or was it me? Maybe it was me. Maybe I was in denial of fears I didn't have the courage to face. Now that I'm older, with fewer axes to grind, I suspect that certain roadways that seemed to lead nowhere weren't the dead ends I saw, but simply roadways marked with warning flares saying that some personal failure was destined to occur. On the other hand, I can't help wondering whether, had I persevered, some of those roadways might have been the very paths I should have traveled most. Maybe along those untraveled pathways, I would have found important lessons waiting to be learned. Still, to step on stage in a professional theater at my age to do a one-man show with voice, body, and mind as my only tools was clearly a risky business. You must be nuts, I told myself on the way home, as the magic of Anne DeVere Smith began to wear off. Over the next few weeks, I attempted a sober, practical, objective, clear-headed analysis of the pros and cons. I realized that whatever force was drawing me nearer to this sizable undertaking had origins too troublesome to untangle. After a full month, I still hadn't been able to shake off the magic of the theater or regain a safe distance from my old friend compulsion. The cautious side of me resisted this business of walking on the edge, especially now, at an age when a fall was likely to be fatal. The wild side of me, on the other hand, was ready to accept the fact that high gains require high risks. In the end, I agreed with the wild side and resolved to go forward on the basis of two compelling reasons. First, I needed to settle obligations owed to self. Second, in the process, I wanted to spin enough magic to close out what had been for me a genuinely magical career. Like a fighter in training, I started preparing for the event. I watched other actors in other theaters do solo evenings. I researched actors and textural material from successful productions in the past. I paid attention to details, adjusting my social calendar, carved out a preliminary time frame, cleared my desk. But the two most basic issues remained unresolved. Who would write such an evening, and what would be the nature of the material? I put this question to my friend Charlie Blackwell, whom I had met in the late 50s, not long after he had arrived in New York from Philadelphia to pursue his dreams. Like young unknowns before him, he went to New York to conquer Broadway as a dancer. But the times were insensitive and the pickings were lean. Race was a factor, and denial was comfortably in control of virtually all questions concerning race in the America of those days. Though he had danced with both the Pearl Primus and Jeffrey Holder companies, times came early on when he had to sell cigarettes for the Philip Morris Company to cover the rent. Once, when things were at their bleakest, George Mills, a fellow dancer, asked Charlie to accompany him as a drummer on an audition for an upcoming musical called Fanny, to be directed by Joshua Logan and produced by David Merrick. George Mills didn't get the job, but Joshua Logan and David Merrick saw something in the drummer, enough to offer him a job in the show, a spot that would make use of his dancing talent. The show was a hit. Charlie Blackwell was launched, but not as a dancer. David Merrick was impressed with his quickness of mind, his critical thinking abilities, and his overall grasp of the technical nature of live theater. During the next 20 years, Charlie would move through the ranks in the Merrick organization to become a master stage manager. He went to London to direct the Merrick productions of Promises, Promises and 110 in the Shade. After that, he wrote the book for the Broadway musical, The Tap Dance Kid. And then he wrote the movie A Piece of the Action for my company, and rewrote Stir Crazy for Columbia Pictures, which I was privileged to direct. Along the way, he had written two additional movie scripts for my company, so I knew of no better person for the job at hand now. I laid out the plans to Charlie, but he said he had commitments and obligations that could be long-term. When asked how long-term, he gave me a vague response that suggested a reluctance to clarify. When and if I can work through everything that's on my desk at the moment, he said, I'll call you. Strange, I thought. But I left it to rest and turned my mind to the unwelcome task of finding a possible substitute. For many weeks I searched through a mental list of all the writers I knew, as well as others I knew only by reputation. Meanwhile, I compiled notes in case the search ended on my own doorstep. Could I write a one-man show to be performed by me, fashioned out of material, each piece of which would be a living part of my own life? Yes, but not like Charlie Blackwell could. As more weeks passed and more notes accumulated, I saw with increasing clarity what a monumentally formidable task stood before me. However, I had no choice but to press on. Late one morning, the phone rang. I picked it up, and it was Charlie. How you doing? He asked in a cheery voice. Fine, I said, delighted to hear from him. Well, I'm clear now. You still want to do that thing? Yes, yes, hell yes, I replied. Well, I'm ready, he said. What he didn't say and what I didn't know was that in the months prior to our last conversation, doctors had discovered cancer in his bladder. Surgery followed, during which prostate cancer was also discovered and dealt with. We went to work, yet all the while Charlie kept his illness to himself. There was no telltale behavior, and the ostomy bag he wore under his clothing to collect his urine wasn't apparent to any of us. Charlie Blackwell was just as I've always known him. Halfway through the project, my doctors saw warning signs in my blood that maybe my prostate should be watched. Many ultrasounds and four biopsies later, they pinpointed the cancer. It was only then, in an effort to comfort me, that Charlie revealed his history. I underwent surgery for the removal of my prostate on June 3, 1993. When I was able to work, we resumed, each of us hoping that the next 5 years would show no sign of our cancer's return. Months later, we had a completed project. The entire evening was going to be material from my life. Nothing outside of my experience would be added. We were relieved to have finished and were enthusiastic about the results. Charlie went back to New York with a copy of the script that we both agreed should be given to a producer friend of his, someone whom I too held in high regard. Here's where dreams would meet reality, the project's first exposure to objective scrutiny. Despite all our years in the business, we were both wired with anxiety and hopefulness. Then the reaction came. Not good. Charlie and I were disappointed, but we swallowed hard and digested the details. Finally, it came home to us that we had made a mistake in the selection of the source material. We were forced to admit that the material should have been taken not from my life, but rather from life itself. We resolved to return to the drawing board with this new point of view. Charlie and I didn't see much of each other over the next several months, a time spent mostly in note-gathering. Early one evening, he dropped by to visit with my wife and me at our New York apartment and to report on his progress. An hour later, we shared a cab with him across town. My wife and I were on our way to the theater. Charlie was on his way to somewhere else. At 97th Street and Columbus Avenue, he got out. We said our goodbyes, and we never saw him again. The cancer had returned. He died on June 2, 1995. Sometimes it seems that when crushing losses are the reality, a resistant mechanism springs into action to protect the mind from instant overload, mercifully allowing for the gradual absorption of invasive and toxic information. Charlie Blackwell was no more. He had slipped into what W.E.B. Du Bois once called that long, deep, and endless sleep. Needless to say, the world we knew hung heavy in the days and months that followed. After the magnitude of the loss had hit home and family and friends were able to turn the corner toward healing, I drifted back to the material in progress. I remember thinking of it at the time more as material in shambles due to Charlie's untimely departure. As to questions that remain standing in the face of humanity's relentless pursuit of answers, maybe nature arranges it to her benefit that some of us set out on journeys that can have no end. Consider for a moment that the amount of energy spent by human beings in pursuit of something that doesn't exist might, in very real terms, represent a sizable chunk of the energy nature needs to make the world go round. Which might also explain why, even after a lifetime of struggle, most of us never find the rainbow we promised ourselves would lead us to our pot of gold. Charlie never lived to see our dream fulfilled. The same cancer that declined to take me called him back to nature. I don't know why he died any more than I know why I went from being a stargazer on the beaches of Cat Island to an actor in Hollywood. But I do know that I'm responsible not for what happens, but for what I make of it. It's up to me to take my own measure, to claim what's real, to answer for myself. I'm still here, and truth be told, the compulsion to create and express is still here. Our first effort at a one-man show met with failure, and oh, how I hate to fail. My colleague has succumbed, and to an illness that I've shared, which is at times doubly dispiriting. But I still dream of that final moment on stage. Surely this must be the highest stakes game of all, and maybe the oracles are trying to tell me that this is one I can't win, that my survival instincts aren't going to help me this time, that I won't be able to charm this opponent into neutral, no matter how much drive and hard work and talent I apply. But there's still a beating heart at the center of my being, and while there's life, human life is a highly imperfect system filled with subordinate imperfections all the way down. The only thing we know for sure is that in another 8 billion years it will all be over. Our sun will have spent itself, and the day it expires you'll hear the crunch all over this solar system, because then everything will turn to absolute zero. But you can't live focused on that. You can't hang on to that. Anyway, luckily we puny individuals have only 75 or 82 or 96 years to look forward to, which is still a snap in the overall impenetrableness of time. So, what we do is we stay within the context of what's practical, what's real, what dreams can be fashioned into reality, what values can send us to bed comfortably and make us courageous enough to face our end with character. That's what we're seeking. That's what it's all about, you know. We are, all of us, a little greedy. Some of us are plenty greedy. We're all somewhat courageous, and we're all considerably cowardly. We're all imperfect, and life is simply a perpetual, unending struggle against those imperfections.
Hello, this is Cherry Jones, Tony Award-winning actress and narrator of the Little House on the Prairie audiobooks. As an audiobook listener, you know the pleasure of being captivated by a well-told story. You may not know that children who listen to audiobooks enjoy academic benefits as well. Hearing stories read aloud helps children reinforce important fundamental elements of reading readiness and reading comprehension, two key elements of overall success in school. When children listen to recorded stories, they hear and learn new vocabulary, and they practice active listening skills. Children can also listen up. Advanced readers can find challenging and complex stories. Delayed readers can listen and enjoy the story as a whole before breaking it down into smaller pieces. For all children, hearing a good book encourages a lifelong love of literature and reading. So, when you consider what to listen to next, why not also think about the pint-sized listeners in your life and select from one of the many available children's audiobooks?
We hope you've enjoyed this program from Harper Audio. For more information about the broad range of titles from Harper Audio, Harper Children's Audio, and Cadman, please visit our website at www.harperaudio.com. You can also call 1-800 331-3761. Thank you for listening.